Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Take a hurricane, add in some tariffs, and then start thinking about what that's going to do to the cost of rebuilding. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 13th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A quick look at any of the cable news channels will tell you what you need to know about Hurricane Florence. It has started to come ashore on the Carolinas. The flooding will be deep and the damage will be heavy. And the rebuilding, when it eventually begins, because it will, is going to be more expensive than it might have been just 6, maybe 8 months ago. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going.
After a disaster like a fire or a hurricane, the surge in demand for raw materials like lumber and steel raises prices for those goods. Jock O'Connell at Beacon Economics says after this hurricane, there's another factor to consider.
We've got the complicating factor of tariffs on a lot of these products.
The U.S. has imposed 20% tariffs on lumber from Canada. There are tariffs on steel and on gypsum, which goes into drywall. Tariffs on household goods that'll go into homes, like furniture and appliances. Chad Bown at the Peterson Institute says that'll create shortages during the recovery effort.
And that's going to mean higher prices for consumers and make it even costlier for them to have to rebuild.
Homeowners felt those price hikes after wildfires leveled entire communities in Northern California last year. Jerry Howard is CEO of the National Association of Home Builders. He says the risk of flooding with this hurricane will make home repairs more costly.
You have to rip out the wood, you have to rip out the flooring, the walls, because it becomes an issue of mold.
The research firm CoreLogic estimated that the cost of reconstruction after Florence could reach $170 billion. Jeff Slegomelch at Columbia University's National Center for Disaster Preparedness says we could cut recovery costs if we gave more thought to development and infrastructure, things like where we build houses.
Don't build them in a floodplain would be one example. Our electrical infrastructure is highly vulnerable. It costs more to protect these things. It costs more to reinforce our infrastructure and our homes.
But without doing that, he says we're on the road for more surging disaster costs in the years to come. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
One always hesitates to dig too deeply into economic research papers. Apologies to economists here, but things can get wonky in a hurry. But there is a new paper out from the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston that says historically a low unemployment rate, and remember we sit at 3.9%, that can actually signal trouble for the economy. So we put Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson to the task of explaining the dangers of too much employment.
You get a job. You get a job. Jobs for everyone. How could this possibly be anything other than great for the economy?
When the unemployment rate is very low, the odds of a recession following that are very high.
Ann Owen, an econ professor at Hamilton College, says we don't know for sure why low unemployment might cause a recession.
But one of the reasons why this might happen is actually a result of the Federal Reserve's reaction to a very low unemployment rate.
The link could be something like low unemployment can push up wages. Higher wages cause higher prices, aka inflation. But part of the Fed's job is to keep inflation low. So to counteract rising inflation, it raises interest rates. Because if you make borrowing more expensive, people will borrow less, which slows the economy. Ideally, the Fed slows the economy just enough to keep inflation in check.
They're trying to do what they call engineer a soft landing. And what this paper is saying is that, well, they haven't actually been very successful at that.
At least not historically. But is past prologue? Carl Tannenbaum, the chief economist at Northern Trust in Chicago, says this time might be different.
We have pushed unemployment to a very low level, and yet we have not seen the same kind of wage increase that we've seen in past expansions.
The silver lining to slow wage growth is lower inflation. So
the Fed's reaction can be more measured and the chance of a recession reduced.
The Fed could finally engineer that elusive soft landing. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it's all good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You've heard by now about the president's tweets this morning about Puerto Rico, right? That 3,000 people didn't actually die in the hurricanes that hit the island last year, that number was cooked up by his political opponents to make him look bad. Those statements are not grounded in fact at all. What is a fact is that Puerto Rico was devastated, that thousands did die because of a lack of electricity and shelter and food and water. Jose Andres is a Michelin star winning chef. He's got a string of high profile and profitable restaurants. And since the storms of last year, a reputation for something else as well, feeding people when disaster comes. Andres got to Puerto Rico 4 days after Maria hit, and through his nonprofit, World Central Kitchen, served 3.5 million meals. His new book about it is called We Fed an Island. Chef, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You tell a really good story about getting to Puerto Rico, about going to the ATM and pulling out a couple of $1,000 in $500 chunks and reserving airplanes and all this stuff. You get there, you land. Obviously, there's destruction. What was your first thought? What was your first, all right, here's what I'm going to do?
Well, what I know is cooking. And I've done this all my life. I feed the few, but I've been feeding the many. And very quickly, we began only cooking. I thought we were going to be doing a few thousand meals a day, and I will leave some money and one kitchen functioning behind. But the days passed by, and very quickly I learned that the island, the local government, the federal government, and the big charities, they didn't have a feeding game.
The thing that hit me in that first chapter, and we should say here, you have a restaurant down there, and you've been working in Puerto Rico for a while, but you got off the plane, and it seemed like you knew everybody, and knowing everybody helped you set up supply chains and lines of credit and all of that.
I think all my life, I always love to knock on the doors, even in those doors that I don't know anybody behind the door. And I'm good at that. I think we all need to knock on the door when we want to achieve something. So, I got some help that obviously some people knew me because TV or because yeah. I've been going to the island a lot. But at the end of the day, what I try to do, every problem, we try to transform it into an opportunity. And that's what, just in a very simple way, got us going.
I wonder, though, Chef, how much of your success down there was because you were, in the beginning anyway, right? You were small and you could basically just decide, right? You were going to do it and you went and did it, as opposed to some of the bigger organizations that, it's clear in this book, you had a really big problem with FEMA and some of the institutions that, were sitting in meetings and doing things bureaucratically. I mean, you were immensely frustrated by that.
I want to make sure that I believe that the great men and women of FEMA, they are my heroes. They do an amazing job, as well as many of the men and women in the big charities. But sometimes I do believe that leadership fails the people, and the red tape freezes simple solutions. For example, we saw that was 1 million bottles of water used in an airport. We knew about that water, but was other water going on around the island? And sometimes we ask the question, can we use that water? Can you give me the water so we can take it to the 78 municipalities around the island? We know where people without water live. No, we're going to give it to you because now you have a contract with us. Say, okay, can you sell it to me? Sorry, the federal government doesn't sell water. This is the level of nonsense that sometimes happens in emergencies. Shouldn't we make the system simple? We should be partners of the federal government, not use a contractor. I was not there to be hired for a job. I was there to lead and take over on a mission that seems nobody was taking seriously, bringing food and water to the hungry people of Puerto Rico.
So I'll tell you what, Chef, your emotion there brings to mind a scene in this book. You have a press conference to express your frustration with FEMA and with bureaucracy and with, we just want to feed the people. And you think the press conference was a great success, but the people working for you, the chefs, are a little bit annoyed because they had to stop cooking for an hour.
Yeah, but that's normal. That only shows you that everybody has a voice, everybody has an opinion, and that's important. But, thanks to that press conference, with the money that the federal government put at the disposal of World Central Kitchen, we were able to keep feeding millions of people. And you need to remember that we didn't show up one day to take the photo and put it on Twitter and Instagram and say how cool we are. Every time we made contact with a community, we kept going back, and we kept going back every day without missing a beat. But the fun part is that we were helping the local economy, buying local bread, vegetables, fruits, and in the process start helping Puerto Rico to come back.
You ask this question at the end of the book, and then you answer it. So I'm going to ask you here so you have an opportunity to explain it. How is it that a bunch of chefs ran what became a giant company, basically? What do you guys know about business is your question at the end of this book.
Well, at the end, chefs, we function very well in chaos. Kitchens are chaos. But, you know, I will not give myself an A, like maybe Mr. President has done. I wish I was more maybe diplomatic with FEMA, and maybe they will really give me more power to reach more people. We were not supposed to be there, so, you know, we did okay. But I wish we were able to feed more people, because maybe we wouldn't be talking of 3,000 deaths.
Jose Andres, it's a book called We Fed an Island. Chef, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm going to roll the dice here and cross my fingers that my mom's not listening today. And mom, if you are, close your ears for a little bit here, would you? Because I know what I'm getting you for Christmas. Apple did one of its big reveals yesterday, new phones mostly, but also a new Apple Watch. Thinner, with a bigger screen, some new health tracking gizmos as well. Those are getting most of the attention. Less attention, though, is being paid to a feature that might turn out to be the real disruption. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
Help! I've fallen and I can't get up.
Help is on the way.
You've probably seen this ad for Life Alert or ads for the other companies that can notify emergency services at the push of a button. Yes, there are other companies. And now, says Apple COO Jeff Williams,
Apple Watch Series 4 can detect a fall.
And if the watch detects no other movement for 60 seconds, the watch can automatically dial contacts or 911. Jeff Kessler at Imperial Capital says Apple is a direct threat to an industry growing as quickly as baby boomers are aging.
We estimate the old line personal emergency response market at $4 to $5 billion.
Money that comes in part from equipment rentals and monthly fees. But these older companies have been rolling out new technologies. Medical Guardian offers a smartwatch that connects to its dispatchers. Dispatchers Apple doesn't have. Medical Guardian's Howard Teicher.
I think there's still a very large gap of time before my customer is comfortable enough to swipe through a device when they're specifically just looking for emergency services.
The industry expected Apple would make this move eventually. Surgeon Shay Gregg created the medical alert app Fall Call Solutions that runs on the Apple Watch. He thinks seniors will prefer its design.
It's imperative that we make sure that we offer them solutions that they're not embarrassed to wear, that they're proud of.
Something Apple's banking on as well. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
People all in the same t-shirts holding these big opt-out today signs, like the pit of my stomach just dropped.
Organizing against organized labor. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 147 today, 0.5%, closed at 26,145, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 59 points, about 0.7%, 8,013. S&P 500 up 15 points, 0.5%, 2904. Supermarket chain Kroger tumbled 9.9% on worse-than-expected second-quarter sales. The company said its efforts to rearrange stores were partly responsible for its disappointing results. That is happening in my local Ralph's, making me crazy. Seriously, where's the peanut butter? Do you know where the peanut butter is? Walmart traded down 0.8%. Costco discounted 0.4% today. Chipmaker Qualcomm clicked up 3.9% as it announced a $16 billion share buyback. Bonds fail. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. From the There Is a Business Opportunity to Be Found in Everything file, this item, The Fear of Missing Out. According to the Interactive Advertising Bureau, podcast advertising revenue in the United States last year was $314 million. That is just a little bit less than double what it was a year earlier, which is nice, but far, far short of the $7.3 billion business that is paid podcasts in China. Now, yes, advertising and paid podcasts is a little bit apples to oranges, but $7 billion is a whole boatload of money driven by a whole lot of FOMO. Our China correspondent Jennifer Peck explains from Shanghai.
Chen Jun lives in an old apartment in Shanghai. It's a squeeze with Chen Jun, his wife and kid in one bedroom, his brother's family in another, and his parents sleeping in the living room. But he says he's usually out working overtime. With a two-year-old daughter and family responsibilities, Chen Jun says he must work hard and dream big. At a nearby restaurant over lunch, Chen Jun tells me he was working as a database engineer and earning almost double the average salary for white-collar workers. But he recently quit the job to invest in cryptocurrency. Chen Jun says he was inspired by this podcast. It's by Bitcoin tycoon Li Xiaolai.
The podcast is called The Path to Financial Freedom. Now, who wouldn't be attracted by that?
Chen Jun pays $29 a year to subscribe. This is part of what people call the pay-for-knowledge economy, podcasts and asking experts online. Last year, a $7 billion industry. What's driving the demand? According to government-backed research, it's a combination of factors: desire for useful information to keep up in China's competitive job market, and a phenomenon known as FOMO, the fear of missing out. The report says,
the simple act of buying information online helps alleviate people's anxiety about their knowledge gap and makes people feel that they are not left behind.
That's why Chen Jun's cell phone is loaded with paid podcasts that offer practical solutions like how to make your voice more attractive. The man behind this popular show is broadcasting professor Zheng Wei, who's based in Beijing. He says most of his 200,000 subscribers are white-collar workers anxious to keep up in the big cities.
Some of them still have accents from their villages and make fools of themselves in social settings.
For less than $3, Zheng Wei's podcast promises to help listeners get the right accent and right vocabulary, and he's not worried that similar tips can be found online for free.
China's middle class feels that free content will not be good quality, and that paid information is more useful.
The industry is still experimenting with what content people will pay for, and it's casting its net far and wide, all the way to Minnesota, where economist Timothy Taylor has been approached to do a podcast for China's biggest audio platform, Himalaya.
What you do every day that is not included in GDP.
His podcast is based on his book, The Instant Economist, which explains economic terms. Taylor has no plans to do a podcast for an American audience and doubts his show in China could be commercially viable in the U.S.
All the classes at MIT are up free online now, you know? So if you want an intro econ class, you can go get one.
Taylor says he has gotten a nice advance for the podcast, and payouts to podcasters can sometimes be very lucrative, says voice coach Zheng Wei.
The revenue share from the podcast platform can be more than what we as professors can earn in a lifetime in China.
He plans to make more podcasts because he says people are eager to improve themselves. That includes me. So I asked the broadcast expert for his take on my skills.
Your Chinese isn't bad for someone not born in China.
But I can improve, he says, if I subscribe to his podcast. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
The Senate Judiciary Committee voted today to officially not vote on Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court until next week. More of a procedural thing than anything else, but closely watched along party lines, you know the context. There was, though, a ruling at the end of the court's last term that Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman was watching pretty closely. A 5-4 vote in a case called Janus v. AFSCME, which said that unions that represent public sector workers, government workers, that is, those unions cannot collect fees from non-union members to pay for things like collective bargaining. That decision took a chunk out of union cash flow and has set up a new battle for the hearts and the minds and the wallets of public sector union employees. From Portland, Oregon, here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
I pull up to a modest ranch house on a tree-lined street in Salem, Oregon. There's a pickup in the driveway. A sign on the lawn reads, Proud Union Household.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
I meet Sarah Campos, 34.
The morning after the Janus decision, there were some folks at my work site trying to encourage people to opt out of the union.
Campos works at a state agency in communications. She's been a member of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, for 10 years and used to be a shop steward. She remembers the anti-union activists that day in front of her building.
People all in the same T-shirts holding these big opt-out today signs, like the pit of my stomach just dropped. Working people trying to encourage other middle-class people to do something that's not in their best interest.
For years, SEIU and other public employee unions knew the Supreme Court was poised to cut the cash flow from fees on non-union members. To get ready, they ramped up communications, outreach, and organizing to get members to stick with the union. Campos met with fellow workers in the weeks that followed, touting union wages and benefits and protections against being fired without just cause.
Which is what happens every day in the private sector and one of the most fundamental, right, I believe, of a union contract.
The people passing around opt out of your union cards that day were from the Freedom Foundation, a nonprofit free market advocacy group based in Olympia, Washington. It's one of several conservative right-to-work organizations nationwide campaigning to decrease union membership and political clout after Janus.
So we sent this around to about 180,000 public employees in Washington.
Labor Policy Director Max Nelson says the group has a $3 to $4 million budget, and it's hired dozens of campaign workers to do mailings, social media outreach, and door-to-door visits with public employees on the West Coast. He says reaching them is crucial because their unions have
a financial interest in making sure that people don't know about and don't exercise their right to stop paying union dues.
Here's a promotional video they're distributing.
My name is Kate, and I've been a teacher for 18 years. They took my money and spent it on causes and agendas I don't agree with.
It's a pitch to workers' pocketbooks. You can quit your union, keep your dues, and still get union benefits for free. Ben Rast is a Washington State safety inspector and Freedom Foundation supporter. Until the Janus decision, about $50 went from his paycheck every month to the state employees' union, even though he never joined.
They do provide a service, collective bargaining, and I'm sure they have been responsible for a good portion of the pay and benefits I now receive. Ultimately, it's not a matter of the money. It all comes down to First Amendment rights.
Max Nelson says the Freedom Foundation's outreach effort is at maximum capacity right now. But Leanne Kunze with the 30,000-member Washington Federation of State Employees says the campaign's had little effect so far.
Ultimately, we know their goal to wanting to defund and defang the labor movement, but we have made internal and external organizing the number one priority.
Since the spring, Kunze says her union's lost nearly 1,000 members, while 770 workers have joined up. Sarah Campos's union in Oregon, meanwhile, is up on net. New members outnumber quitters by 3-2. We'll have to wait until the Labor Department's report on union membership next year to find out how public sector unions nationwide have fared in the wake of Janus. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today in which, look, I'm just going to apologize in advance for my fellow males, all of us. Bloomberg asked a market research company to go back through corporate earnings calls. 19 years worth, 155,000 calls where companies report profits and losses to see who talked more on those calls, men or women. Men, duh, 92% of the conversations and questions were from men. Now, that could be because there are just more men in that slice of the economy. Could be. but it isn't. To quote the CEO of the company that did the research, male executives provide significantly more verbose answers to analyst questions than their female counterparts. And one could surmise that male executives are more prone to speaking simply to hear themselves speak. So, like I said, sorry. Really, what I should do is just not say anything here, right? Just be quiet. Just let it end with the music. But I won't. Dow Industrials up 147.5%. NASDAQ gained 59.7%. S&P 500 up 15 points, about 0.5%. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.